Again, we're under a little bit of time pressure tonight, so I want to bring Greg Dibb up, who's the Senior Manager of Operations and Strategy here at the Nissan Silicon Valley Research Center. He's been with Nissan for 9 years in various capacities, originally started down in Southern California, moved to Franklin when headquarters moved out there, has been at various locations in the country, and is just here recently, right? Yeah, okay. So he's going to give an overview of what they do here. So, Greg.
Thanks, Howard. I'm glad to be here. I was super excited to... You guys are, like, famous at Nissan. I mean, I'm serious. Like, we get updates about you in our monthly communication email updates. In fact, I'll show one at the end of my presentation. I will say, though, my son didn't know about you. And so when I was telling my wife that I was going to be speaking to the Bay Leafs, my son got super excited and ran back and got his Pokemon encyclopedia and came back. And now he thinks I'm so cool. And I didn't have the heart to tell him it was a different thing. So if any of you ever meet my son, don't tell him, all right? Don't tell him the difference. Yeah. Okay, so first I was going to tell a little bit about manufacturing, because I actually came here in December for manufacturing. Now, given the time, I'm not going to show the cool video, but I think one thing that's exciting about the Nissan Leaf is that now we build it in Smyrna, Tennessee. We build it here in the U.S., and it's built on the same lines as the Nissan Altima and the Nissan Maxima, which is pretty cool. And so I just came out here in December. And actually, the job immediately before this one, I was a production manager, actually on the truck assembly line. But at the same time, they were doing the prototype builds for the Leaf, and we were all very excited about it. Of course, the battery plant was built there over the last several months. But having the Nissan Leaf in Smyrna has actually been very exciting for Nissan. And it's one of the reasons that I think we can build it so economically, because we've made our line flexible enough that we can fluctuate between Altima, Maxima, and the Leaf, which is pretty innovative. My background is and my grad school was actually in systems engineering and manufacturing management. And so I studied what's called lean manufacturing. Are there any manufacturing people in here? I'm just curious. Two, all right. And have you heard of lean manufacturing before? Okay, good. So I'm kind of – I'm the one Nissan North America – or I should say the first. There are more joining us. From Tennessee that came here to Sunnyvale for this research facility. But because I've been in a few different groups, I'm kind of the connection back to the auto business, as well as what I hope to do is take some of what we've learned in the Nissan production way and apply it to Nissan research. And what I've learned is there's actually a lot of things that relate. So for one thing, Nissan production way talks about always being in sync with customers. And you can see there's 1, 2, and 3, synchronization of quality, so that we don't accept defects, we don't build defects, we don't pass them on. Synchronization of cost. In other words, we're not going to spend resources on things that our customers don't care about. And synchronization of time. We don't do things before they want it, we don't do things after they want it. We try to be in sync. So what I've learned is that's very similar, obviously, to our research efforts. So here we're looking at things that are 5, 10, 15 years in the future, but we need to be connected with people such as yourselves that are users and maybe even early adopters and those with even better understanding of the usefulness of product, what issues there might be, what things we can do to improve. And so our goal, of course, here is you can see what we call the lean research cycle, which is the plan part is a scenario development. What's a scenario where we might use this technology? This is a really hard word to say, so I'll try it here. Ethnographical user observation. In other words, we actually watch you, or we interview you, we talk to you, we learn what it is, how you would use this technology. And then, of course, the design of the prototype and the design of the product that we want to build is based on those human needs, on those human factors. And then, of course, we actually want to do real tests in the real world. And then based on what we learn from those real tests, we then do another scenario. And the point is fast research cycles yield faster learning, yields better products. So this research center here is actually, we're the newest research center. We've got a new research center in Russia, in India, of course in Michigan, and Japan historically has been where the primary amount of research has happened, and as a new strategy, we're starting to distribute some of that research work. And this facility primarily focuses on three things that we'll talk about here. The main thing I'm going to talk about is autonomous vehicles, because that's really our priority and the one we're starting with, but also connected vehicle services and HMII, or human machine interface and interaction. And really, they're all interwoven in lots of different ways. I'm primarily going to talk a little bit about autonomous vehicles, because that's the one that we've gotten started on first and the one that I'm most excited about, and the one I prepared slides for. So this is the first known visual concept of an autonomous vehicle. And it's kind of cool. Oh, it's a little hard to see, but you can see this guy in the front here. I'm gonna point with my mouse. Does that work? It looks like he has an iPad. Does anybody else notice that? How cool is that? I mean, I seriously think he's playing Angry Birds on an iPad, which is even more foresightful than putting an autonomous vehicle, I would say. And then she's reading a book. He's cleaning windows. I don't know, but I thought this was pretty cool. 1918. It's in the Scientific American, talking about this idea, only 15 years after Henry Ford's Model T. So now, this is the first, unless you count this, right? So as I've been researching autonomous vehicles, I read a particular article, and there was a comment from a guy who said, oh man, my grandfather had autonomous vehicles in the 19th century. And he talked about how he ran a warehouse that delivered goods to general stores around Germany. So this is in the 1800s. And because he ran the same route, every day, the oxen knew the route, and they would even stop in front of the store for the exact amount of time to unload goods, and then they'd start going again. So he'd have to, so he could sleep on the cart. He could go do something else and hop back on before the oxen left. So that's qualified by the fact, and this might be a new research domain for us, is the use of oxen in autonomous vehicles. So this is pretty cool, too. If you look, after that initial picture, you look at what you can see. 1939 World's Fair is where people really started to hear and see this concept. It must be close. At least they thought in 1939. And then by 1953, in Driving the Dream, they actually had this is pretty cool. It's this scale model highway system. These World's Fairs must have been cool. But you can see the idea has been around for a long time. Now, DARPA, which is an acronym for the government has a lot of money to do cool things, created the DARPA Grand Challenge in 2005, which really helped kickstart a lot of this technology. And Stanley, which is Stanford's car, actually won in 2005. So this is through the Mojave Desert. No driver. You have a map. They put obstacles in the road, and the car has to figure out how to get around them and get to the end. That was pretty cool, and PBS did a show on that. Now, the Discovery Channel did the one on the 2007, which is the DARPA Grand Urban Challenge, which was really pretty cool. And I got to show this video. Hold on, let me see. I hope this works. Uh-oh. I don't know what that says, Koji. What does it say?
Windows Media Player
has crashed, does not work on this machine. Oh, well, that's too bad. It wasn't that good a video anyway. Okay. Hold on. So the good news, as I say right here, you can watch it on Netflix and YouTube. And but it's honestly, so when I first heard about this center, I started watching this show. It's a Discovery Channel show on robocars. And it's really exciting to watch. It's like your typical reality TV where they make everything seem exciting. And everything's dramatic with dramatic music. But it's super exciting because you have, I think it was 13 finalists in... that actually made it to this abandoned Air Force base in Southern California, which is another thing that the government has a lot of. And there's this urban course, and so there's four-way stops, and there's little obstacles they put in the road that you might find in the city, much more complex than going through a desert. And CMU, or Carnegie Mellon's vehicle, actually won this race. So, again, I recommend you check it out. It's a pretty exciting little season series to watch. And again, that helped jumpstart research, that helped jumpstart the technology into autonomous vehicles. So these are a couple of shots. And the other good thing about the DARPA Challenge is pretty much all their stuff is made available publicly. And that's part of kickstarting the technology. So you can look up these papers and you can see what kind of technology they use. Now, this is 6 years old at this point, but the things that we're working on are very similar. This is just easier to show for now. So, and this might have been impressive in 2007, a 4 gigabyte flash drive, right, or 2 gigabytes of memory. But since now those are like $5 at Fry's. But hey, that's part of what's making this possible now, right? So even though they dreamed about it in the 30s, part of what's making it possible is massive amounts of storage, massive amounts of computational power, so that when you have these sensors, all these sensors on the computer seeing this, you have the computational power to try to figure out what that is. And here, basically what the CPUs are all doing is they're bringing in the input from the sensors, they're calculating an optimum route. Basically, the way it works is you can see the red and the black; those are what the computer considers high cost routes. I.e., you might lose your car; that's expensive. So go where it's white, right? And so that's what's starting to make this possible. Is all Moore's law really? It's giving us all this computational power and all of this storage, and it's increasing at an accelerating rate. So obviously the biggest benefit. One of the biggest benefits of autonomous vehicles is the safety, right? And there are a few different stages of autonomous vehicles, and that is in our research plan. So the first, and we've got stuff like this now, and I'll give examples, is driver-initiated. In other words, I turn on the adaptive cruise control or I turn on some feature, and then the car does its function, right? Now, the other thing that gets a little more interesting, and we have some of these on the market now, and every once in a while it might freak people out, but in general, they improve the safety. And I'm not going to say in general. Almost always, they improve the safety of the vehicle. So car-initiated, where the car sees that there's something dangerous, and it basically takes over. It intervenes. And a middle step there is where the car sees something, and it alerts you, right? So there's a lot of those out there. Well, the next step after seeing and alerting, the next is I, the car, see it, and I'm overriding you. So that happens in a few things. I'll show specifics in the next slide. And obviously the great thing about this is a fewer number of accidents. People who are impaired, now a lot of people think that means driving drunk, which, that doesn't usually make people, that doesn't usually touch a soft spot in their heart for a new technology. But more so than that is the aging population, right? So I know an awkward time in a family's life is when you have to take the keys away from grandpa, right? Well, this hopefully... we can get this technology to the point where instead of taking the keys away from grandpa, it's giving him a new keys of a Leaf that's autonomous, right? And so it's actually an exciting moment, and not just those that are, aging but also vision impaired. And so there's a popular Google video, for example, that Google's done with a person that's visually impaired. And there's all kinds of possibilities for that, which, of course, drive us to develop this technology. And then, another one that selfishly... increase productivity is that, during my morning commute, I can do whatever I want while the car drives me there, or on a road trip or whatever it is, or like the guy in the picture playing on your iPad, Angry Birds. And part of what our philosophy is, which I think you might see a little different from other companies that are developing this, is the car and the person or the driver as teammates. And this is a lot of where a lot of people we've hired have come from NASA, where they've worked and focused on this teammate concept. When in artificial intelligence, this thing or this either machine or computer acts as an agent on your behalf, and you actually work together as a team. And so the example that we use is an equestrian and a horse, right? So the car is not going to do things that scare me or that I don't understand if it's designed well with those human factors. We communicate back and forth, and it's like an equestrian and the horse, where they're always communicating. It's flows smoothly. There's nothing awkward about it, right? And that's part of the research we have to focus on. So I'll just say this. Autonomous vehicles are actually here, right? Some of the examples I gave, like adaptive cruise control, we've got on vehicles. We've had them for – they've been driving people crazy for a few years now. So but they're getting better. And I wanted to show – Nissan has a concept – called the safety shield. And there's a lot of examples of these semi-autonomous technologies that we have in our vehicles and that you will see soon. So one, for example, this one backup collision intervention. We have this on a couple of vehicles. So if you're backing out of your driveway, and this one means a lot to me now because I have kids that love to somehow escape from the garage and ride their bike, you know, down the sidewalk and back before I can catch them. Well, if a car is backing up out of the driveway, and, you know, they got bushes because they got annoying neighbors, so as they're backing up, they don't see the kid on a bike coming through, but the car can see it because the bumper emerges from those shrubs. It sees something there, and rather than just alert, hey, you might want to look, it actually stops the car, right? It actually stops the car. You've also got emergency assist for pedal misapplication, which I know from experience from some friends happens a lot, you know, and where you're pulling into a parking spot and you think you're stomping on the brake, or you meant to stop on the brake and you accidentally stomp on the gas. Well, the car can figure out, I'm in a parking lot. I don't think you meant to do that. I'm going to wait. Then, of course, blind spot intervention and warning. We've got that on vehicles now where, again, it will either alert you or override you when you try to change into a lane and there's a car there in your blind spot, right? Lane departure, we've had that. That's been around for a while. Forward emergency braking, similar to backup collision, just in the front. Now, this is a cool one, and I wonder – oh, shoot. Now, the video probably won't work on this one. Hold on. It's this one right here. I'm going to try a new trick called open with. Wait. If it exists in Japanese.
You want to play, right?
Yeah. Oh, hey, look at that. Okay, and there's even cool music on here, which I cannot take credit for, nor would I. Okay, so this is the autonomous emergency steering system, which is also pretty cool. So let's say an accident like this, similar like this happened to my dad, because as you drive from Nashville to Atlanta, Chattanooga's always backed up for some reason. And so you're driving along at 70 miles an hour, you know, you're thinking about who knows what, and then all of a sudden cars are dead stopped in front of you. This happens, right? Well, heck, you guys are in California. This happens to you every day. So here's an example of where, again, computers and sensors can see this happening and then intervene. See, pretty cool, huh? So again, you see, and in this case, it gives you a little bit of alert, and then it takes over and steers. Now, it does have sensors, see, to know I'm clear on the left side. Usually, it would be like a shoulder of a road, perhaps, or something like that. But I'm clear on the left and on the left back, left front, and I'm able to go. So, there we go. So, again, that's another example of Nissan's safety shield. Okay. Okay, so we're almost there, right? At least maybe we could say that. However, there's just a few small issues to work out before we're completely at the fully autonomous state. Now, what do you guys think are the biggest, obstacles to, yeah?
Legal.
Legal, there you go. Yeah, and I like lawyers. It's like they say, deep down, they're all good people, which is why they bury them 10 feet down. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if you're going to say any more, but I spoiled what I was already going to say, which is society accept them? And in fact, Cisco did a survey just, a couple months ago. And different countries are widely varied on whether or not they would accept, at least they say that they would accept autonomous vehicles. So Brazil was like the number one country. You know, they want one now. You know, I don't care if it racks, put me in it now. Other countries were less enthusiastic. The U.S. is somewhere in the middle. And in fact, a lot of people think that that autonomous vehicles might be implemented first in places like China, in urban areas in China, or places where the litigious society isn't as hyperactive as it is here. So, right? And my friend Brad Templeton, as he says, you know, on the balance, it's a good thing, right? But let's say autonomous vehicles can stop half of the wrecks, but maybe they still cause some. You know, as Brad Templeton says, people don't like getting killed by robots. Is his quote, and so they would rather get killed by a person who makes a bad decision than a robot that makes a bad decision, and that's part of society, obviously. Now the good news is I actually did. I went to a We Robot conference at Stanford Law School just a couple months ago, and it was actually encouraging to see there are lawyers out there that specialize in these things. In fact, we had one, Brian. I can't think of his last name right now. from Stanford that's focused on this kind of thing right now. And it was encouraging to see the legal world excited about this and looking for ways to make the and enable this. Yeah. Well, to make money off of it. No. Maybe that's what they were doing. Darn it. Should have known. Those punks. I'm just kidding. Okay, so just a couple of examples real fast. Actually, I'll just skip through most of this. So, you know, you got self-parking. You got simple stuff, which is going to happen first, semi-autonomous. The car can park itself. Nissan demonstrated this at CTEC last year, this little leaf right here. You know, you got traffic jam assist. That's on its way. Driving on a highway is pretty simple. You know, I mean, there's the simple stuff is almost here. It's practically here. Then you've got the slightly more complex where you're doing stuff as a service, where you use autonomous vehicles and car sharing. You know, maybe the only thing they do autonomous is they go back home at 3 a.m. when the roads aren't crowded, and they can handle that because that's simple. The real exciting stuff is people own their own autonomous vehicles, so I can go on a road trip. Now, that has its pluses and minuses if you have kids. It's nice when I'm the driver and there's a fight in the back. I can ask my passenger to take care of that. But if the car is driving, I would have to help resolve those things and, you know, figure out whose chicken nugget that really was. But there's, you know, a lot of opportunity, and this is obviously further down the road, but reduce collisions. And now, if there aren't so many collisions, now the vehicles can be lighter. They don't need as many safety features, right? So you're going to save money on that. Insurance should be cheaper unless the lawyers get hyperactive. And then you know, the flexible in-cabin time, you can use that time for other things. Obviously, we talked about age and disabled passengers. So, and then, of course, fully autonomous is it doesn't need a driver there to take over in case there's an emergency if it goes into safe mode. It can go by itself in full traffic anytime. So this is our autonomous vehicle that we were working on. Stay tuned because you saw our little research cycle. We plan to do some public demos sometime in the near future. Can't say specifically when or what, but it should be coming up soon. So, maybe in California, probably. But yeah, when it's public, we'll certainly invite you guys. So, what next? I just want to let you guys know a little pitch about a podcast. We have a meeting here. You know, we have speaker series here, and we record it. Certain groups might specifically be invited in person, but we make it available on iTunes for podcasts. So search iTunes for Driving Innovation. I also lead a meetup group called Silicon Valley Autonomous Vehicle Enthusiasts. And Brad Templeton, the guy I talked about just earlier, he spoke last month, and that's available on the podcast and also on this website. I wanted to thank everybody for inviting me here to speak. I figured it was because I was made famous by when we made it in the newspaper. I was at the Western Automotive Journalist Conference, and that's my foot right there. I was so excited. I sent this picture to all my friends and said I'm on the newspaper here in California. These are coffee pots. Yeah. Well, they don't have quite the technology we do. So these are our little Epro robots right here, and these are those. Laser sensors, by the way, LASIK sensors, which are basically you have spinning mirrors, or in this case, rotating mirrors, and lasers on multiple lines that are very good at detecting an obstacle and knowing exactly its location. So, and pretty much everybody uses the same kind of sensors. And I skipped through that slide pretty quick, but come to find out, it wasn't because of my being prominently figured on the newspaper, but. But it was unfortunately, Martin had to be out of town last minute, so maybe it had something to do with that. And so he asked me, and I had a video of Martin. Is this going to work? Because Martin really wanted to say something. So I'm going to let you do that again. Play that again.
It's going.
Okay, here we go.
Hi, good evening. I'm Martin Seerhaus, the director of Nissan Research Center Silicon Valley, and I want to... wish you a warm welcome here at the Research Center to all the members of the SF Bay Leafs. We're really excited to have you guys here, have your monthly meeting. I wish I could be there in person, but as I'm speaking, I'll be on a plane back from Seattle to San Francisco, and I apologize for not being there. I do want to tell you, however, that we are hoping to Have you collaborated with us in the future on exciting research projects where we would use your expertise and knowledge of your cars to work together on, you know, great research projects to make the Leaf even a better car than it is today? So hopefully we can work together in many different ways, and I'll make sure that next time you have a meeting, you know, I'll be there in person, and we can we hopefully can talk about this in more detail. I wish you a lot of fun tonight, and please let us know if we can be of any help. Thank you again for coming, and enjoy the evening.
Okay, so, and with that, this is a cool picture. This is one of the pictures that was emailed to us a couple months ago. I thought that was a brilliant picture. So as the title says, let's sync and innovate together. And as Martin said, I know he's very excited to work with this group in the future. Our goal is to be very customer focused and develop technologies and research that matters to people. And so thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Is Japan in yet or not yet? So I guess while we're waiting for Japan, we'll take some break. Can you take questions?
Oh, yeah, I guess I can.
Okay, good. Tom?
I was wondering, is the Leaf drive-by-wire enough that to make an autonomous vehicle, you just have to put computers in to talk on buses, or you actually have to put it servo someplace?
So where's Yoshi? Where's my helper? So it's drive-by-wire, but it's not steer-by-wire, which is what you need, right? So you have to make a few changes. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, driving in a severe storm, how do you keep the sight there?
So it depends on the sensors, right? And most of the sensors that you have in your autonomous vehicle are usually the laser sensors that I mentioned, like a Velodyne. And those that the weather hardly affects them at all. Now, cameras, weather can affect cameras, but we're developing computer vision that can get around that too. So usually by a multitude of sensors, and then what you do is you take the computers to merge that data and interpret, and then basically you calculate a probability of what's happening, and your probability is so high once you've merged the data from all these different sensors that you make a 99.999% decision that you're doing the right thing. Yes. So the question was how do you handle snow? So the way it's handled now is that you have very detailed maps, right? And the easy answer is that's not completely figured out yet. But the way it's handled now is you have very detailed maps, and you have much more much higher resolution GPS, and you have certain waypoints and certain landmarks that you can recognize even if there is snow. So again, it goes back to the multi-sensors. You know, that would trick one sensor, but it's not going to trick all of the sensors. Yes?
Have you done any research on the more autonomy there is in driving these cars, if it just reduces driver skill so that you might save some areas, but if people can clueless after a while when they have to take over, they don't know what to do?
Yeah, no, that's actually a good point. I will say that's something that we've discussed. I won't say that we've done research on that yet, but we certainly thought about that and discussed that, because you're absolutely right. One of the mid-steps would be that the car drives itself most of the time, and maybe it goes into some kind of safe mode, and it transitions in some safe way to the driver. Well, if the driver hasn't, you know, if the driver's only driving 3 minutes a day, then, you know, that's perhaps, how does this impact their skill? And especially if they're a 17-year-old and they didn't have any skill in the first place. You're right. Yes?
Did you guys have some interesting discussions following the crash in San Francisco recently? Just think in terms of, you know, like we were talking about, you have pilots that are... You know,
oh, the airplane crash. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what I'm interested to see, and certainly we have, but what I'm interested to see is to suspend judgment until... I haven't read today what happens. What we do know is that over 80% of accidents are driver error, and in the case of airplanes, you know, pilot error. Again, the difficult thing for society is going to be that first accident that's the computer's fault, right? on a vehicle, because most of the time the airline industry, usually it's accidents are when the pilot or the co-pilot make a poor decision against what the computer recommends. And I'm sure there's experts in here above me. Yeah.
So what you need for that is the car black box constantly recording what your autonomous vehicle driver is doing, and then you record when you avoid an accident, and you have to press out of that. So if this was a human driver, you know, 90% chance that would have been an accident of X severity, right? And now you've got that. So when you have that accident, then you really put it in the balance. So yes, the robot caused one accident, but avoided nine.
Yeah.
It happened to the human.
Yeah, yeah, and the hopes is that, you know, that the courts agree with that, right? That 90% improvement is a good thing. Yes?
Is there anything about an electric car that makes it easier?
I would say yes. There's a few reasons why that's true. One of which is the drive-by-wire, for example. Are we on now?
Kia's in, yeah. So go ahead and finish up the...
Okay, and we'll, okay. And given that we have the Nissan Leaf, we believe that to be true as well. You know, and I was talking to Paul Saffo, with my friend Kimmy over there, and as he said, something seems just improper about having an autonomous vehicle that runs on gas. You know, it's like, you might as well have oxen, right? I mean, let's be honest. There's no future in that. All right, thanks, everybody.
All right, thanks. Great.